a saint, maybe might be nice.
Greetings, brethren, and welcome to episode 2 of Dear Uncle Tony, the podcast featuring songs, stories, poems, interviews, and reflections from the siblings of the Psy chapter. I'm your host, Kate Goodnight. We hope you enjoyed our first show and that you're inspired to contribute something of your own. Stick around at the end of the show for details on submitting content. This episode, we've got a bunch of terrific segments, including original songs and poetry, as well as part 2 of my 3-part Get a Job interview with Noel Ocon. First up, we've got Brother Keenan Brown with his vocabulary lesson turned poem.
My name is Keenan, for anyone who doesn't know me already. I am a Psy 14. Today I'm going to share a poem that I wrote it in French, so I'm going to try to translate it afterwards. I wrote it like frustrated in my French class, all these vocabulary words that I just like didn't know in all my reading. And so I wrote them all down and like forced them into this poem. You know what? The poem is called L'Abandon, which is l'abandon. So, tantôt il arrive avec volonté, ainsi que le feu dans la grande nuage, et sa voix qui perce votre volonté, dévouement contre votre courage. Ceux qui fuient à survivre la crainte sombre, les larmes naissent tomber le parfum mouillé. On s'aperçoit, on poursuit ses ombres. Il me quitte sans parole et sans débrouiller. Il me lâche en dessus le réseau fort qui me prend de sa main comme les eaux de l'âme. Mon esprit se mêle avec peu d'effort. Mes songes me gênent avec une telle pertinence. Lesquels restent en mes eaux, essayer de s'échapper. Je tombe debout, espérer de la chance. And so, now I'm going to try to go through it and translate it. Sooner that he arrives with the light, in the same way that lights dance in large clouds, the needle pierces my will. Devotion against his courage. Those who flee satisfy the pain. Tears fall from the wet ceiling. They catch sight of the pursuit of our shadows. He leaves me without speech and without mumble. He leaves me under a strong river, which leaves me disarmed in the water of hatred. My spirit mixes with a little effort. My dreams bother me with such pertinence, which rests in my bones trying to escape. I wait, standing in hope of chance.
Thanks to Keenan for letting us record him at a Hall alumni event last year. Perhaps he should look into designing a French language magnetic poetry set. Next on Dear Uncle Tony, if you know her, you love her. She wrote and performed the theme song to this very podcast. It's Charlotte Parrott.
I'm still Charlotte Parrott, and this is a song called Troubled Children.
This is an anthem for my young adults and adolescents who have trouble sleeping or have difficulty learning lessons. If you skip basic math to stay home reading Plath, you wonder why the world's fucked up and you're not scared to ask. For more perfect children, put your hands in the air and wave them back and forth so that we all see you there. Oh, my troubled children, your hands where they are. No need to prove we're having fun. You know we mean something to someone. It's for the young ones who are introverted, introspective. We find their scripture in that brand new animal collective. Mom thinks her hair's too long, or that you're living wrong. Well then, it's to you I dedicate this song. Oh, my perfect children, put your hands in the air and wave them back and forth so that we all see you there. Oh, my troubled children, keep
has one. I honestly think it's genetic. Some people just feel more. And honestly, I don't regret it. Sad people worth feeling for. Oh, the perfect children, put your hands up high and wave them really quickly so we don't see you crying. Oh, my troubled children, keep your hands where they are. Bless you, I'm shake mine. I think that you're just fine.
A big thanks to Sister Parrott for sharing her music with us. Now we'll turn to a set of short poems by Sister Lee Tuckman.
Hello, this is Sister Lee Tuckman, Xi-05, recording from Sydney, Australia. The following are some excerpts from a series of poems I've written, prompted by the major arcana of the tarot deck. I wanted to provide a little bit of context for one poem in particular. Shortly before writing The Empress, I learned that in Japan, often when women get married and have children, their husbands stop calling them by their names and start just calling them mother. This nickname isn't just to help babies learn what to call them, it continues for the rest of their lives. So you can end up with the kind of funny but also pretty sad situation where a man calls to his wife in a crowded supermarket or train station, and a dozen women all turn to see if they're being called, because they all respond to being called the same name, mother. The only other place I've seen such a complete erasure of a woman's identity is when you look at old gravestones and the man's has a name and dates on it, but the woman's just says mother on hers. The idea of motherhood being a culturally all-consuming aspect of womanhood is very powerful and frightening to me. 3. The Empress. Tokyo Station is full, and all of the women turn as one when a man calls, mother? Their name's fading. As if they are already dead and planted in an 18th-century graveyard. 15. The Devil. Do what thou wilt, and it harm none. Do what thou wilt, and that shall be the whole. Do what thou wilt, because, let's be real, babe, you never could do anything else. 0. The Fool. It is the tactic of girlhood. Look naive, look away, look like you don't know or understand. Look blank and pretty, look like they expect you to look, look like you don't know what you're doing, look like you aren't paying attention, look like it's a mistake, look like you don't know they're looking, look like you aren't looking, look. And then step over that cliff edge, knowing full well. 2. The High Priestess. Here we are again, the recurring dream. You are the one bright thread woven through the endless dark. The golden crack in the world where the light seeps in, like a door about to open, about to close. I have never seen you. I climb out of the blood, there is only more blood. But you are there, somewhere. I can feel it. Maybe just behind that curtain. Maybe tonight. 6. The Lovers. You could worry about my family history of pancreatic cancer, and whether I can retire on an artist's salary. But darling, either you'll still care in 40 years, or you won't. 10. The Wheel of Fortune. Inevitably, I wake from the dream. I forget the trick to flying, but remember who I am. 21. The World. There is a stone at the heart of the world, like the stone at the heart of the fruit. Eat this world whole, and when you die, a tree will grow on your grave. Every mystery is just a secret you haven't been told yet. Every mystery has three more hiding inside it. Turn this stone over, if you want, underneath another stone.
I know you've all been eagerly awaiting the next installment of our Get a Job series, with the second part of my interview with Sister Noelle Ocon, Xi-1986. A quick refresher before we jump in. Sister Ocon currently works as a conservator of paintings at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh.
So you're talking about, I mean, all kinds of different stuff. Is there a particular painting or any piece, really, that you're looking forward to working with or have worked with that just tickled your pink?
Well, yes, actually, and it's the one where we ended up going to Cornell. I talked about her Eureka moment before, and I've had several, but there's this one painting by a 17th century Flemish artist named David Sneers the Younger, and it's an armor shop scene. So you have a pile of armor in the foreground, a couple people working at a forge in a background, and an armorer working on a tool to the right. So it's a typical genre scene that was common in the 17th century. So I was working on the examination, the documentation, and I saw something funny in the x-ray. And I thought, what is going on here? I cannot figure this out. And I knew David Sneers and Jan Brueghel the Younger were contemporaries. You know, they worked together at the same time. They were related by marriage. So I was looking through a catalog raisonné of Jan Brueghel the Younger, and I'm like, oh my God, there are four paintings by Jan Brueghel with the same exact pile of armor. But this is a David Sneers painting. It's signed David Sneers, and it has all of the David Sneers hallmarks. Like, I call it a Sneers table. He puts the same table in all of his paintings. So I thought, it's two paintings glued together. It's two paintings glued together. Can this happen? And this actually took several years of talking and looking. And I talked about how we did non-destructive testing. Well, I did take cross-sections, which were destructive. But there's no way I could take enough samples ethically to answer this question of if it was really two paintings glued together. So long story short, we went up to Cornell and we did hundreds of virtual cross-sections. And we found exactly where one painting began and the other ended.
Wow.
It was like, cool. Oh my gosh. And actually, there's a painting in Avignon at a museum that they reattributed to Jan Brueghel the Younger based on my research with the armor.
Wow.
So, yes. And there's lots of cool things about the painting. The armor, most of it still exists. One of the armored gloves is in Krakow. And that was discovered back in the 40s, where all this armor was. There's so many cool things working with the physicists at Cornell, the art historians, and then we had the dendrochronology done on it, which is tree ring dating, which showed that the paintings were painted 20 years apart.
Huh.
So the mystery remains, why? And
right.
I don't think we'll ever answer that. There is this guy who calls himself an art psychic, and I actually considered calling him to see if he could figure it out, but I moved on.
Yeah. Did you have any sort of idea of what you hoped might be the story?
Well, they were related by marriage. David Sneers was married to Jan Brueghel's sister. And a lot of artists would paint the same subject over and over. So I figured they're at, you know, the ball game, and Brueghel's like, hey, I've got this painting I painted of a bunch of armor. You want it? And Sneers goes, yeah, sure. And then he glues another piece of wood to it and paints the rest of the composition. Since they knew each other, it had to be some sort of collaboration.
Right, or just like, oh, you know what, Betty, your piles of armor are just so beautiful, and I can never get it right. If you'll just do my pile,
yeah,
I got the rest.
Yeah.
Nice.
So that was a very exciting moment. There were several exciting moments over the course of a few years, and it's been published in many different scientific journals and art journals. If you Google me, a lot of this comes up.
So you've got your own spot in the history as well as these guys.
I do.
Yeah. And now you're related to them.
I know.
In a manner of speaking. That's really cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about some of the specifics of what you do broadly on the day-to-day, but switching fields a little bit, how about your field in general? Like, what are your colleagues like?
That's an interesting thing because, first of all, there are stereotypes among the different types of conservators. So I specialize in paintings. I specialize in old master paintings. Paintings conservators tend to think of themselves as the cream of the crop because they're working on quote-unquote real art. Now, I don't feel this way. Well, I am a painting snob when it comes to 17th century Dutch Flemish, you know. That's my thing.
Sure. Sure. Anybody goes toe-to-toe with you, you were right.
Yes. And then you have paper conservators who tend to be sort of the poor stepchildren of the conservation field because they work on so many different artifacts, and a lot of times it's archival material, not art.
Sure.
And they tend to be a certain sort of quiet personality, I'd like to say. And then objects conservators tend to be gung-ho because they have to work with so many different materials. A lot of times they're not working on fine art, they're working on archaeological material. So I can work on a 17th century painting by Jan Steen, and they might be working with clumps of dirt someone dug up. So there's sort of those stereotypes within conservation. I think what has both helped and hurt me, it's that I take my job seriously, but I don't take myself seriously. You meet a lot of conservators that are buttoned up. A lot of conservators actually started in the medical field. But I am not a buttoned-up personality. I wear orange Crocs, and I laugh, and I have octopuses on my apron at work. But I think that's both helped because I'm very good at what I do, and I also am very good at speaking about it and talking to the public at many different levels. But I think also it's hurt me because sometimes it can be seen as a lack of professionalism. And I understand that, and I'm aware of it, and apparently have chosen not to change that.
Hey, no, you got to be you, and if you're doing good work, there's always recognition for that, I'm sure.
Yeah, and then the field itself, it's very small. It's very difficult to get into. First of all, there's three programs in the U.S., and all of them, you have to have art history and chemistry. Yeah, to be comfortable with the qualitative nature of art history and the quantitative nature of chemistry and physics. And then not only do you have to have all that to get into school, you have to have experience. You have to have probably worked at least a year or two as an apprentice. And that is what stops most people because it is very hard to find an internship. Most of them are unpaid. They want you to work 40 hours a week for free, which I was fortunate I did not have to do that. I had a very special experience with a woman who I greatly admire who gave me a chance back in 1992. And she really taught me almost everything I knew before I got to school, and that just corroborated a lot of what I knew. But that's the difficulty, and that's the phone calls we get in the lab all the time. Can I intern? Can I volunteer? And it's very difficult in the museum setting to do it. So most people end up looking for people in private practice. So that is the biggest stumbling block to anyone who wants to get in the field. And then getting into school, each program only has 10 slots, and maybe 70 people apply to each slot.
Wow, so that's 30 nationwide with three different programs. Wow, okay.
Yeah. And then, of course, afterwards finding a job. Everyone's talking about STEM now, and museums, I believe, are still valid, but we have to reimagine the modern museum. And just finding people, they end up going fellowships, internships, contracts, and ultimately many of them go into private practice. Let's say you had a painting that was given to you by your mother that needed cleaning, you would go to a private conservator.
So even though it is a small field, do you think that there's, I mean, do you feel like there is a need for more folks to be doing this? I'm sure there's, God, millions of artifacts out there and all kinds of stuff that haven't been fully examined and nobody's got the time or the resources necessarily. I guess it's a tricky question because I know a lot of museums have public funding, grant funding, although I'm sure many of them have endowments as well.
Yeah, I think there's room in the field. I think that the most of the room in the field right now is dealing with contemporary objects, digital media, installations, and these raise all sorts of questions that I'm glad I don't have to answer because I work on old stuff. You know, like the people at Smithsonian dealing with Neil Armstrong's spacesuits, dealing with rubbers and plastics and stuff like that. That is actually a burgeoning field of research. One of the things that we need more of are actually conservation scientists. We work with them. Someone has a PhD in organic chemistry, and they do the analysis. So they do the X-ray fluorescence. But that is actually a field that is developing quickly. But it's such a difficult field. It's something that I wouldn't necessarily encourage people to go into. But when you have that dream, desire, that passion, of course you have to follow that. So we always try to dissuade people, and then there are some people who are just going to do it. And it's interesting. The modern conservation it started really in the 50s, where you started looking at the scientific aspect of painting and where you took conservation out of craft and into science and into technical ability. The three programs in the U.S. were all developed around the same time in the early 70s. So what's going to be interesting is all these people who started out in the field are going to start retiring. And hopefully we'll see some movement within the field. But there's just not a lot of movement within the field. For example, if I left my job, let's say I wanted to get a new job, I'd have to leave the state of North Carolina. There's not another job like it in a two-state radius.
Yeah, wow.
Museums are weird. They're just like corporations. The problem is not the job, it's the people, right?
Right, yeah, definitely.
Thanks to Sister Ocon for her in-depth look at how to get a job in her field. We'll have the final installment of her interview in the next episode of Dear Uncle Tony. And after that, we'll talk to Brother Adam Hukins, Zai 2001, about his job experience in New York City. And speaking of jobs, Brother Eric Clayton and Sister Obi Morton presented this sleepy little ditty at alumni last year. It may be a raw cut, but hey, it's the blues.
All right, so yeah, Obi is also a pianist, and more advanced pianist than I. She.
Nope.
She played flute when you were 4 to 16, is that right? Yeah. So yeah, we were talking yesterday, and we wrote a little blues tune together. So we're gonna play that to start off. Okay, so a little bit of the background for the inspiration. Obi and I both work at a daycare. When we were just brainstorming, Obi's like, the theme should be kids, so it's called the Naptime Blues. She said, I'll see you at 6. She said, you spend your time with some pickup sticks. She said, during nap time, you be good little boy. But all I want is some kind of toy. I got the nap time blues.
I got the nap time blues.
The nap time
blues. He's got the nap time blues. My teacher told the boy you better stay on your mat. Talked to her like she was talking some smack. Grabbed me by the belly, put me under my feet. I ran away from her and gave my diaper.
Teacher, can I have a book to read? She takes a look at me and says, that she rather that I stay on my mat and sit. If I've learned curse words, I'd tell her she's full of shit. Naptime blues.
She's got the naptime blues.
Naptime blues.
Well, do you got a spoon to eat your stew?
Scoop up the carrots, the broccoli, and the regrets. You know that something must Round with more regrets.
Thanks for tuning in to the second episode of Dear Uncle Tony. Special thanks to Brother Michael Williams, Sister KJ Garner, and to all of the contributors you heard on the show today. The interlude music you heard on the podcast is Ode to St. Anthony by Sister Charlotte Parrott. Dear Uncle Tony is a production of the Siblings of the St. Anthony Hall Side Chapter, presented by the St. Anthony Association of North Carolina. The podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. If you'd like to contribute content to the show, you can contact us at submissions@DearUncleTony.com, or you can leave us a greeting on our Google Voice line at 919-709-DEAR. That's 919-709-DEAR. If you're feeling shy about hearing your own voice recorded, you can always support the podcast and the Zai Chapter with a secure online donation at www.stanthonync.org/donate. Thanks again for listening. Respectfully submitted.